I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. We have a great guest joining us today, but before we dive in, I want to share a brief update about Passing On Outdoor Mentors, the nonprofit organization that I am very gratefully employed by. By the end of this year, we'll have planned just over 500 youth events in the state of Kansas and Iowa, and I'm just crazy proud of that program. And so thankful for everyone, our volunteers, our landowners, and our sponsors who've made that possible.
And Brittany, that is absolutely fantastic. I know pulling off that kind of effort has to take a ton of planning and lots of volunteers. Congratulations on what's going to be a fantastic season. Hopefully a few of those mentees develop a true passion for the outdoors and get to enjoy a long lifetime of that fellowship and just being outdoors.
Oh yeah. It truly takes a village. I know it's such a cliche thing to say, but we have to have so many folks on board to help us, you know, grow our mission and grow the number of kids we get outdoors. And you're right. We're seeing a lot of these kids get so excited about the outdoors that they are hunting more and more on their own. In fact, one of the young ladies we've been mentoring for about 3 years now shot her first buck this weekend. And she is just thrilled and has this dream to create a field-to-table kind of restaurant at some point in her life. So it was just really exciting to be part of that journey for her. And you know, a lot of that is made possible through landowners, but also state agencies like the Department of Wildlife and Parks. So I do want to say thank you to the department for allowing us such great opportunity to hunt through special hunts programs or through hunting weehaw in different public land areas. We certainly get a lot of kids out on those types of lands, and we're thankful for that. So some of the behind scenes work that the department does is research work, from surveying and testing to investigating reports from the public and helping support department policy. We know that the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks has plenty on their plate. Today's guest, Matt Peek, is no stranger to wearing many hats for the agency. Matt is a wildlife research biologist for the department. For nearly 20 years, he oversees the fur bearer, pronghorn, and elk programs, coordinates large carnivore investigations, and other unique duties like overseeing prairie dog surveys across the state. And we're really excited about chatting with him about some fun topics today. Matt, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Well, thank you, Brittany. Yeah, well, you kind of summed it up there. I've been a wildlife biologist for the state for actually a little over 20 years. And I'm a native Kansan. I grew up in East Central Kansas and don't live too far from where I grew up today. So, I do a lot of different things that don't fall into the other game coordinators' jobs and keeps things interesting, that's for sure.
It was fun chatting with you a little bit before we got started here about the other duties as assigned and just the uniqueness that your job probably comes with.
Yeah. I get a lot of the questions from the public to the general department and email and stuff that, like I said, don't fall into other people's categories, but a lot of stuff like what dug this hole, what kind of scat is this? I got some blurry animal on my trail camera. What is this? So I have fun with a lot of sort of investigating different stuff like that and trying to figure out trying to solve some wildlife mysteries, I guess. And also just generally to assist people with problems they're having in their yard or their field or whatever, how they might resolve those issues.
Okay. So you mentioned somebody with that blurry picture from their game camera, right? And I think that's a good segue into one of the topics that I wanted to talk about today is and you're in the large predator investigation, right? So I'm guessing what do you entail there? What's your large predators that you're investigating typically?
Well, yeah, I say large carnivore response, but that includes mountain lions, bears, and wolves. And we've had all three at the state in modern times. And so there is some chance that in any of those reports turn out to be legitimate. And the abundance or the frequency that those species are in the state varies a lot between them. And so our response then differs as well, depending on what the which species is being reported.
Sure. So one topic that I always find is interesting, I always get a kick out of it, is all of the urban legends around mountain lions in Kansas, right? Everything from the story about the neighbor's cousin's brother who shot one in his pen of weaning calves and he put it in his deep freeze. And then the next day, Wildlife and Park showed up because it had a GPS homing beacon in it. You know, where my mind goes first is you guys must have one heck of a budget to be doing that and tracking mountain lions to that level, right?
Yeah.
or maybe the concept of Kansas Farm Bureau Insurance Agency has funded Wildlife and Parks to go trap these mountain lions from some other states and bring them in to help with the white-tailed deer population to cut down on deer vehicle collisions and insurance premiums. I've legitimately heard that at some coffee shops. So
sure.
Let's talk a little bit about, I guess, where you get your funding, what that looks like. You know, I mean, are you sitting in some, you know, fantastic laboratory with caged mountain lions and all this at your disposal, or what's the reality here, Matt?
Yeah, well, there, you bring up some interesting points there, but a lot of those rumors and myths, you can look at the fact that they're pretty prevalent, or at least used to be, in about every state in the Midwest. And so that ought to say something about their validity and the fact that they're not, that, you know, the department hasn't in fact ever reintroduced mountain lions. And And the collaring devices that mountain lions wear are visible in the form of a, you know, they are worn on a collar. And so the idea that somebody would have a chipped one that could be tracked is also not realistic. But the, you know, the reality of the mountain lion situation is interesting in itself, without, you know, without the urban myths and stuff like that. And that is that they have increased substantially throughout the West. We have new populations north of us that didn't exist 20 years ago or 25, yeah, pretty much 20 years ago in Nebraska, North Dakota, the Black Hills of South Dakota population has increased substantially during that time and really reached carrying capacity in the early 2000s before it was hunted. And so it was a source probably of a lot of lions that showed up in the Midwest. But you know, this, and then even states like Colorado that have had, and New Mexico that have had mountain lions for a long time and have had hunting, mountain lions are doing well in those states too. And so really the mountain lion reoccurrence into the Midwest in states that hadn't had them in some cases over 100 years, like Kansas, we went from 1904 to 2007. But the reoccurrence of those animals into the Midwest is sort of a testament to the good management that's taken place in states that have them, where they've recovered to the point that typically subadult lions are leaving those populations and heading eastward. Well, they really are. It seems as some states like South Dakota have collared more of them, they sort of head out of those populations in all directions. But in the cases when they head east, they wind up in, you know, states like Kansas that don't have a resident population, although we have had a number of them pass through. And in fact, this year reached our 50th confirmation in the state. And that's, again, since 2007.
So you mentioned that time frame, Matt, 1904 and 2007. What was that about?
Well, A lot of species of wildlife, of course, were depleted when people were subsistence living in the late 1800s. And I mean, they didn't want the predators. They were using poison, especially to address wolves and coyotes. So the use of poison, there was also a lot of people on the landscape that would have put in the rural, more in the rural landscape in places than there is today, probably a lot more in some places. And so there was a lot more pressure on wildlife. It was before modern wildlife management. And even once modern wildlife management began and sort of evolved, and, you know, beginning in the late 18, early 1900s, and then probably took a big step forward in the 1950s. But even then, these predators like mountain lion remained unprotected in most states until the 1960s and 70s. And so it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that mountain lions received any type of protection or management. And so they've probably been slowly rebounding since that time, you know, since they were first given, you know, the management treatment of having season dates and limited harvest, in some cases tags or permits to take them, stuff like that. Texas is the only state today that has a resident population that doesn't either manage them as a big game animal or a, you know, a fur bearer, as a harvestable species with a closed season. So that's been very beneficial to them. They can't be poisoned. And so they slowly rebounded. And then eventually, like I said, especially South Dakota seemed to be a source for some of these lions in the Midwest. They were research animals. And now today, any animal we get a tissue sample off of, we send to a genetics lab. And in some cases, they can place it back, at least the likelihood that it came from a given source, such as Colorado or New Mexico or Nebraska.
So, Matt, you touched on a lot of points there. And so if we can, I want to just slow down a minute and kind of break that down. You said 50 confirmed lions in Kansas since, was it 04? Is that what you said?
07.
07. Okay. So,
just to be clear, yeah, that's not the number of confirmed lions. That's the number of confirmations. And so some of those animals have been confirmed multiple times as they moved across the state.
Okay.
But that's 50 confirmations total.
So a confirmation, what does that mean? Let's say that I feel like I've got a picture of a cat with a long tail at my deer camera, and I send that to a general email box at Department of Wildlife and Parks at Pratt. You wind up with that, I would guess. And then what?
Well, they would forward that email, goes to the general department email, and they would forward it to me, and then I would reach back out and contact you. And then you actually can't send a picture to the department email, so then you'd have to send me the picture. But assuming it was a big cat, in the past we wouldn't confirm one without being able to go to the site and visit. Now it sort of depends on the situation. We still like to go to the site and look around, because the most useful thing we can get right now associated with these is DNA. And so if we could find scat or a prey kill, which a lot of times when they're passing through, they're eating things like raccoons or, you know, smaller things, whereas the resident lions in most of the western states primarily eat deer. That's not what we've seen with dispersing animals. They're dispersing lions eat smaller prey items and keep moving from one day to the next. So anyway, so once I got that picture, I mean, the first thing I guess I would do is look at the picture and make sure that's what it is.
Yeah.
We do get most of the reports we get are still cases of mistaken identity. So even though we get legitimate ones now too, we do get a lot of bobcat pictures. And surprisingly, the most common thing that's misidentified is domestic cats. And so people misjudge the distance of domestic cats, or it's you know, trail cameras can play tricks on you. They can distort images in various ways. And so people, a lot of times will mistake domestic cats for them, but physiologically those two species are way different, with lions having much smaller head proportionally and much larger front legs. I've heard the mountain lion described as a bodybuilder and a domestic cat as a couch potato, if we were to put them in people's terms. And so if you take two images of the two and zoom them to the same size, they look drastically different. And so we kind of go through that exercise, or I do with the public oftentimes, to try to help them see what the animal they're looking at is. And then we can also recreate size. Anytime you've got a trail camera image, you know, sometimes we'll do this ourselves if there's question. Like I have a life-size lion cut out that I can take out to a site and put it down. And, you know, its body's 4 feet long and the cat's 2 feet tall and stuff like that. And if the picture of the animal was a domestic cat, then this the life-size lion is going to look huge when the photo, if you take a photo from with a trail camera from the same spot, or in cases where it was a cell phone picture, the person can get back to where they were and just take another picture, and you know, you can compare to objects, mm-hmm. to the known objects that you can see in the original photo. And so we can assess size.
So what I'm hearing is that as a research biologist, you have a method that you have employed to research these sightings so that another legend coffee shop talk, right, is, well, the department will never say that the mountain lions are here. And obviously that's not the case, because you have sightings that you independently working for the agency have confirmed through these methods, right? I mean, you're taking your time, you're employed by the state of Kansas, so those, your resources are what they are, and you're devoting that to decide whether this is a legitimate sighting or not.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, Rob. I usually start that conversation by saying that we do take a scientific approach to verifying the reports. And so that's really what it comes down to, is a scientific approach to, you know, to assessing size or assessing the animal's physiology. We try not to, I like to think that we don't guess on these things. And if you're guessing on something, then it's not a confirmation. And that also is true by the same token that there are sightings out there, presumably, that people have made that we didn't verify because we were unable to, you know, there was no evidence associated with it. So when I say 50 confirmations, I'm not saying that that's everyone in the state that's been seen. There are undoubtedly some that are not. But like I said, given the number of mistaken identities we get, there's no way you can take a visual report and tell whether or not it's valid or not, because everybody knows how to describe a mountain lion as a great big yellow cat with a long tail, you know. So anybody can describe one, and there's simply not a reliable or scientific way to assess a verbal description. And so we rely on physical evidence, and that includes tracks too. I didn't say anything about tracks or prey kills, but these are all things that are, you know, that are verifiable, and there's a scientific way to investigate a prey kill, a livestock kill, or even a wild animal kill, for example, and make an assessment.
Matt, we had an interesting situation a year ago. So, well, I guess a little over a year ago, November 21. I live in Wichita, Kansas, and a nice cat was caught on a Ring doorbell. I mean, it was pretty obvious too that this was not a domestic cat. And this picture, I mean, immediately blew up all over our neighborhood chat. pages that we use. And then it was on the news and just, I mean, just blew up from there. Now the situation, I didn't really mind that it was posted, because I think I know what a mountain lion looks like. And I was pretty sure that's what that was. So it didn't bother me too much. But I see all the time on different groups, whether it be Facebook or Instagram, you name it, you know, people posting their trail camera pictures, like, that's got to be a big cat. It's definitely a mountain lion. What do y'all think? And it just kind of stirs up a bunch of controversy and kind of some drama. So what are your recommendations to people who do get these interesting objects on their trail camera? You know, free will, everybody gets to post what they want, right? But what would be helpful as a resident in Kansas, and also to you all at the department in those situations?
Well, we do try to keep track of them. So when people get a photo of one, or, you know, a trail cam, a ring video or whatever, I mean, we appreciate it. In fact, almost all of our confirmations are the result of the public reaching out to us. And so people, I think, at times give the department probably too much credit or too much criticism over whether or not they're present here, because all we've done is for the most part, is take what the public has given us and use it, you know, and look at it scientifically. And so, I mean, we would prefer to be able to see those things and count them. If it is a mountain lion, we like to add it into our database. So and the Wichita one was a really interesting one, but also it's surprisingly not uncommon for an animal that's as elusive as a mountain lion. When they're going a certain direction, they'll just go into or through towns. And they've done this, you know, in a lot of other cities and in some pretty high profile situations. And a couple of them that really come to mind are one in Omaha, Nebraska, and one in Chicago. But the cat, just if it's going a certain direction and there's a city in the way, it may just come right into town. And that's kind of what happened in Wichita. And it apparently spent 8 days in the middle of 400,000 people and mm-hmm. was, to our knowledge, never once confirmed by anything other than two ring doorbell. So it was elusive enough that nobody got a yeah. photo of it, or at least if they did, they didn't send it to us. But Wichita does have a lot of wild space and undeveloped areas, and yep. undoubtedly, and there's a lot of wildlife in town. So like I said, I think raccoons are easy prey for, and skunks and possums as well, and domestic cats. There's plenty of little things in urban areas that mountain lions eat that probably got it through there without being witnessed by anybody.
Yeah, and you're exactly right, too, that mountain lion, the sighting was just, where I think it was confirmed based off of the information I got in our community chat, was just a mile north of us. And so we are a new development that was just, you know, brought into county lines, actually. So you can imagine we're disturbing so much wildlife. I remember when we bought this house, looked out our back window, it was New Year's Day, just snowed a ton. And there's just two gorgeous bucks staring at me. And I'm like, oh, that's wonderful. But then you get to thinking how much habitat you are destroying and what wildlife are moving now because of all of that.
Yeah, that's true. But you also, in some cases, have higher densities of wildlife in town than you do in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So you talk about things like raccoons, possums, red foxes, you know, there's a lot higher densities of them in urban areas in a lot of cases than there is in rural areas. So it is very unfavorable for species that don't do well around people, but it actually is maybe better for those that do. But yeah, in general, I totally agree with your comment there.
So Matt, I'm curious, a couple things would be, you know, is there a sort of a baseline historical archaeological record of mountain lions in Kansas? Like, were you to say, you know, pre Lewis and Clark, we think that, you know, mountain lions were all across the Kansas landscape, and it would not have been uncommon at all for to find them. Or it's like, you know, historically they would have been in these other areas and moved through the state, but we're not. And I get it. Like, this is an educated guess, hypothesis. Like, you know, you've used the science, the records that are there. Number one, so what's the base level? And then number two, do you see, let's say in the next decade or two, right? Your best guess to say, yeah, we are more frequently seeing mountain lions on the landscape in Kansas. Is that due mostly to Ring doorbells and game cameras and cell phone cameras? Or is that truly there are more big cats in the state? And do you see a point in when there's an established breeding population? These are Kansas mountain lions. They're rearing young here, living, hunting on the landscape, and the department will recognize a fur burst season tags allocation, big games. You said, you know, Texas, for example, has a season. You know, I guess those items come to mind, because you hear a lot of that too when we talk about the urban legend. Oh, they'll never, you know, let anybody shoot one, or, you know, and I've spent a lot of time across the prairie trapping coyotes, trapping bobcats. And I don't know that I've ever seen a mountain lion track in the snow, in the mud, whatever. I'm using the same, you know, Minnesota brand 650s. They're going to hold one, I imagine, if he gets his foot in there. So just curious, what is that? What are your thoughts on what was the established base of population, and moving forward, what do you think that looks like?
Well, historically, mountain lions were considered a range across the entire state. And actually, they're the widest ranging. I mean, they are a very adaptable species, and they were they're the widest ranging carnivore in North America, or the widest ranging mammal. They existed across most of the continent, including almost all the United States. And so they were very widespread. And again, that's a testament to their adaptability, living in a variety of habitats. In Kansas specifically, they were not considered abundant. They were thought to have been uncommon, but associated with probably the rugged terrain in the hills in places, but also wherever there were stream corridors running through. They would have been associated primarily with the stream corridors, but again, statewide. As far as the frequency of observations, you know, that's a good question, and one I get asked a lot, because there are old, you know, you can talk to people that say they saw one in the 50s or the 60s, or dad saw one or whatever. And so those stories have been around. So the question is, why are they getting confirmed now like they were? Is it only the result of trail cameras? And I think the answer to that question has more to do with mountain lion populations. Like I said, they were suppressed in Western states, where populations remained for a long time. And so there would have been no reason, and in heavily hunted populations, there's no reason for a subadult male to leave the population, because you have constant turnover and open home ranges. When populations aren't hunted as heavily and populations reach carrying capacity, if those young lions stay, they get killed. And so they have to move out, or there's some really good and interesting research in the Black Hills showed this. Their population was extensively collared and studied. And as that population reached carrying capacity, all of their toms started being severely torn up, missing ears, clawed up eyes and faces, stuff like that. And then their leading form of mortality of subadults became killing by adult toms. And so they literally had to get out or get killed by a much bigger, older animal. And so, I think the changes in the population are the reason why they started showing up in these Midwestern states. It wasn't just Kansas that didn't document them for a long time. It was Missouri and Iowa and Nebraska and you know, Arkansas. There was a lot of these states that didn't have them for a long time. it did sort of correspond with trail cameras. And today, about 2/3 of our confirmations are the result of trail cameras, but we also get lion, you know, lions also, we haven't had a road kill or a train kill, but other states have had them road killed, train killed. We've had them treed by hounds. They do get caught in traps. They've been incidentally shot by people. They've been photographed by people with cameras and or in today with cell phones, but with cameras as well. People have gotten tracks of them. And these are just the modern confirmations that we have in Kansas. People have gotten tracks not associated with the sighting report that we verified. So there's a variety of different ways that they show up. And all of those ways, with the exception of trail cameras, could have happened prior to, you know, in the 1970s or 80s or 90s. They just didn't. And so the strongest indication, and I mean, it's a certainty in my view, is that the dynamics of lion populations have changed. And like I said, we also know there's new populations in Nebraska, North and South Dakota that weren't there, you know, that weren't there, or at least in were not abundant prior to recent times. And then your last question was about whether they might take up residence in Kansas. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
yeah, like a resident population that the department would manage. There'd be, you know, like we see in deer. There's so many deer tags because there's a goal that they're trying to keep the population at, and some of those tactics are, you know, deer tags as a management tool. So, you know, is that something you would see similar? I don't know if it's similar to Texas's method, but to say, hey, there's a season, whatever that looks like, on mountain lions.
Yeah, the first question is whether we could possibly support a resident population here. And as we've sort of done a little bit of a habitat analysis with kind of a not a very complicated habitat model, but as you could imagine, it indicates that most of Kansas is not very good mountain lion population. And so it would seem that we definitely don't have much habitat that is considered suitable in terms of what they traditionally are thought to need. You know, there's too many people, there's not enough rugged terrain in places without, you know, that's unoccupied, stuff like that. But but we do have a lot of prey, and they are highly adaptable. And so if it comes, you know, if it came down to that, it is possible that you know, a lion or that a lion could stop and stay in Kansas. We just really haven't had it happen yet. The thing that's hard for me to, I could see one staying in an area for a while. It's hard to imagine having, you know, 10 of them in an area. It would take a big area to support that many. It seems unrealistic that many of them would stay and that they would be able to survive around the people that we have. So we'll see what happens, but you know, time will tell.
So in the meanwhile, Matt, it'll be interesting to see 10, 20, 30 years from now what that looks like. We'll have to come back and reference this podcast. In the meantime, you know, while people are going to continue to probably have mountain lion sightings because they do exist, and now that we know the department is not responsible, what's the good, the bad, the ugly? I mean, people need to just, you know, let it be because these cats are roaming freely as they should, correct? Like, based off of everything you just expressed about you know, these lions leaving one place to go to another because they're going to get their butts kicked from the other bigger male. You know, this is just a natural progression of wildlife.
Yeah, I think that's kind of reflected in our management philosophy, in that you can't shoot them for just being present. And I will say that they're not actually addressed in our regulations, but Kansas is sort of there's a state law that says you can't do anything unless it's allowed by rules and regulations. And since we hadn't previously had mountain lions, there was no open season or they weren't addressed. And therefore, since the season wasn't opened by default, it was closed. But so right now you can't take them for mere presence, but they're also not excessively protected in that if one were to kill somebody's livestock or were to be found in or near somebody's buildings, there is a state law that generally allows people to control wildlife for those types of things, that mountain lions could be, you know, that mountain lions are wildlife and could be controlled for. So I think right now with the number of lions that we've had and the situations in which they've been documented, I think our current laws and regulations make sense. And so somewhere down the road, if their status in the state changes, we might need to do something differently. But right now, people can address problems with them, and there's really no reason to shoot them or to get rid of them if they're not doing any harm at this point. And so I think we're in a pretty good place with them.
Perfect.
It's good stuff, Matt. Thanks for sharing all that.
Sure. Thank you.
I think we could probably keep talking about mountain lions for, I don't know, another couple hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like an episode of Mythbusters. You remember that?
Yeah, I do too. I kind of like this.
So while we're talking about large carnivores and animals on the landscape that you're getting pictures from game cameras or cell phone cameras or whatever, maybe I'm going to venture to say less talked about in Kansas, maybe more prevalent, I don't know, we'll let you answer that, is black bears in Kansas. So I'd be interested, Matt, to talk a little bit about what you see, you know, New Mexico and Colorado. I've read did a black bear population study, and they found that they had way more black bears. I hate to quote because I don't remember the study specifically, the numbers, but they found that they had a lot more bears than what they initially had thought. Oklahoma has a black bear season. Arkansas has a black bear season. You probably have more knowledge on whether or not Missouri has a season. I think they do.
Yeah, they just recently opened up a season.
So if basically every state surrounding us has a black bear season, you know, I'm sure not statewide, but let's talk about black bears in Kansas, if you don't mind.
Sure. We've had a handful in the state, and when we've had them, they've been in the southeast or the southeast and the southwest corners. They had primarily been in the southwest corner, associated with, around the Cimarron National Grasslands and associated with the New Mexico and Colorado populations, which of course the New Mexico population would have come through the Oklahoma panhandle as well. But so since the early 2000s or so, I don't think it had been too uncommon to have one down there typically. And then they also have started showing up a little more frequently in southeast Kansas. And almost all of these bears that we've had have been young subadult animals, and they've almost all been in May, June, July, which is the breeding season for bears, and when the mother kicks the previous year's young off and are away from her. And so they then wander around sometimes for a while before they eventually make their way back to occupied territory. If they're lucky, they make it back, I guess. So I think since 2015, according to my records, we verified 10 of them, and we verified those 10 animals about 20 confirmations out of that deal. Bears are typically more visible, and maybe a little more diurnal, and so people have seen them and got trail camera footage cell phone footage of them and videos of them and stuff like that when they were driving down the road. And they also are grazers and stuff. So you might see them out in a wheat field or something like that.
So we're talking about, like, in Oklahoma, you've got like the Ouachita Mountain Range going up into the Chautauqua Hills, comes up into southeast Kansas, kind of the Ozark touches just a little bit. So, I mean, is that sort of the landscape you're talking about? Rugged hills, timbered, rocky areas of the very southeast part of the state?
Yeah, that's what, that's probably the best scenario for them. Now, again, you're talking about another species that's very adaptable, and in parts of the East, they live right amongst people, and you know, they can, being highly omnivorous, they can make a meal out of a lot of different things, and so they're pretty adaptable. But yeah, I think the best situation are those types of rugged, wooded areas that are unoccupied. There's no doubt in Kansas they run into conflicts here, and so it would be a lot easier for a person to move into bear country and to deal with bears than it is to have bears move into Kansas, into our landscape, and have people get along with them. They do cause problems with things like honeybee hives and people feeding corn in deer feeders, stuff like that. They'll sometimes knock, you know, aluminum feeders down. And so if people knew that they were going to have a bear to deal with, they would need to, to get along with them, they would need to set up some bear electric fencing around beehives and gardens and orchards, stuff like that. And, you know, and have deer feeders set up in a manner that bears can't get to them. So there are a number of things, and we work with a program called BearWise, and there's a website that you can find by searching BearWise that provides all types of information on how to live and get along with bears. So that's something we try. As we've had a few more bear, we're getting more involved with BearWise and working harder to notify people about the possibility of making some adjustments in the things they do. And of course, another obvious one is having bear-proof trash containers or not leaving them in a place that a bear can get to them. But
so is that like something a big raccoon. You've had an issue with somewhere in Kansas where bears were getting into somebody's trash?
Not necessarily their trash, but we have had one of the bears in southwest Kansas. I mean, they'll get into grain, people stored grain, stuff like that. So that was kind of a problem. Luckily, we haven't had too many nuisance bear issues, or at least they've not made it to us. And so, but you know, your question about mountain lions as to whether or not they could take up residence here, I suppose there's a possibility that southeast Kansas could hold a few bears, but the first thing that has to happen is people would have to be willing to tolerate their presence. And that's still a big unknown in my view as to whether or not people would tolerate them. Things like leaving your grill out on your porch is not very, you know, if there's a bear around, you're going to attract him up onto your porch. So even some pretty basic things like that, people have to change their behaviors to get along with bears.
Gotcha. Good stuff.
Yeah. And I guess the question then goes, do we want that, right? do we want bears living in Kansas? I don't think I know enough to really have a say one way or the other, but I would think that it would be very hard to get the public excited about that.
I've got a friend that lives in Manitou Springs in Colorado, and they had a bear get into their Subaru.
Oh my.
had groceries in the back hatch or whatever of the car, and carried in a load and came back out in whatever time. I think there was a time lag in there. It wasn't like immediately back out. And somehow that smell of those groceries in the back of their car attracted the bear, and he worked on the car enough and managed to get a door open and apparently it shut behind him, and insurance totaled their Subaru.
Oh my gosh.
Because the bear ate the car, essentially, like, the dash and the upholstery, and like he was just in there and he couldn't get out, and he found his way to the groceries. And
how so funny.
But that it's would interesting. Be
very, very startling to walk upon and find that.
Yeah. But you know, I just think about all up and down the East Coast and the Appalachians, the Smoky Mountain Range, the Rocky Mountain Range, the Sierra Nevadas. And like we were talking about, Oklahoma has a hunting season. They're taking some mm-hmm. huge bears in Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, you definitely can't leave food in your vehicle. I've seen video of them opening, you know, they're, it's like a raccoon getting in a cooler in a camping area. If they learn how to do that stuff, you know, they can, if they learn, they can learn to open car doors and all types of stuff. And so people just have to be, you know, really aware of where they're leaving their food, and you better not leave it anywhere you don't want them to get into, because yeah. at certain times they will. I mean, they've got to put on, they hibernate, and so they have to put on a great deal of weight. And so, prior to winter. And so they really have a one track mind, and that is getting food in the fall there. And so that's yeah, all
I like what you said earlier about being mindful. Like, we're not very good at doing that. So that's definitely a good, I think that's just a good posture to have in life in general, right?
Yeah. And it's doable. I mean, people do live with them. They've managed to, the people of Missouri have lived with them to the extent that they've increased, you know, that bear numbers there have increased to, I think, over 800 last I heard. And so, you know, it is possible. People live with them, and bears live amongst people in a lot of states in the United States. So it's not an insurmountable thing, but it does take some work. And you're right. The question does remain, it is whether that is what the Kansas public wants or not. So it's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So we talked about mountain lions and bears. One item I wanted to be sure and visit with you about while we had you on, Matt, was river otters in Kansas. I know after talking with you over a number of years and in the Emporia office, that's a project that you're tied closely with. And to be honest, I think a lot of Kansans probably have little to no idea that there are even otters in the state of Kansas, let alone that, you know, they're a legal fur bear in Kansas. So I'd like for you to just talk a little bit about that, you know, how they got here, when they were here, how they got back, if they were gone, and kind of what that looks like.
Yeah, well, I would like to describe it as a great, you know, as a great conservation success story. And in fact, that is how I describe it. But I say that with the recognition that there are some people who do not like otters, and most of them are carrying a fishing pole in their hands. So, you know, sometimes people are pretty
carefully.
What's that?
So you say that carefully then, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I know that that may be an offensive thing to some people to say that otters being in Kansas is a good thing, because they do eat fish, and they can have an impact in ponds at times on the fishery. But yeah, so I guess I would, we Wildlife and Parks, or at least our namesake before we were Wildlife and Parks, introduced 19 of them back in the 1983 to 85 time period. And I always like to give a shout out to the Kansas Fur Harvesters Association over that deal. I think the Kansas Fur Harvesters, which mainly consists of trappers, were early advocates for that reintroduction. And they recognized that they were a species that had been, that was native to Kansas, but was absent. And so they were early advocates for reintroductions, and they supported the department and partially funded the project to bring those otters in. And so it was a very small reintroduction project, but we did put otters on the South Fork of the Cottonwood River in Chase County, like I said, back in the early to mid 80s. And I don't know that those otters exactly thrived. I do think that they made it down to Flint Hills National Wildlife Refuge, and that there were sporadic confirmations of otters down there over a period of years. But things really started happening with otters in Kansas in about 2000. And in the 90s, Missouri had reintroduced like 800 otters. And so they had the largest reintroduction in the country. And it turned out they were dumping otters into these pristine Ozark streams that are just loaded with crawdads, which is also a favorite food source of otters. And they really thrived there. So starting about the 2000s, we started having otters along the eastern edge of Kansas in streams like the Meritazine that runs into Missouri. And so, and they started working their way westward from there. And then later on, we started getting otters from Oklahoma that started working their way up, like the verdigris and stuff like that. And of course, they were up and down the Missouri, which brought them up the up the Kansas River into northeast Kansas as well. So those were some of the places that they started filling back into Kansas from neighboring states. And from there, since 2000, which I took the fur bearer job in 2001, and so I'd been tracking them for a long time, but we saw substantial increases in the number of confirmations, and we were keeping track at that time of confirmed reports, tracks, road kills, and then also incidentally trapped otters that were taken by beaver trappers in most cases, and whether they could be, in some cases they were released, in other cases they were in body grip traps set in bank dams, in which case we collected all those animals we can get. And I probably necropsied over 100 otters before we started a season on them in 2011. So I was taking all the otter carcasses I could get my hands on, and we really learned a lot about their health at that time, and learned that they were extremely healthy. It was always fun. Part of that necropsy, which is an animal form of an autopsy, by the way, I should clarify that, what a necropsy is, but always look at their stomach contents. And interesting to see what they ate. Surprisingly, a lot of times there was little tiny minnows in there that you'd think was barely even a meal, but they would have little minnows, or sometimes they would have the scales of carp, other times crawdad exoskeletons or part of a frog or bird feathers, but mostly fish, and usually with really small scales, like eating perch and stuff like that.
So if I was at a state park for Labor Day weekend, and I'm kayaking someplace, and I'm pretty sure I saw an otter. It's not a beaver. It's bigger than a muskrat. Is that not that? I've never seen one. So I'm sure it is rare to a level, but it's believable, I guess. Are there certain places, like, so let's say, Wilson and the Saline, are they out that far west? Are they clear down to Cedar Bluff? Or are we talking mostly like east of Salina, some landmarks maybe where most of their range is?
Yeah, that's good question. They probably, some of the westernmost stuff is like Sedgwick County, Wichita area, and south. And I think they're on the increase in that area. Coming from the south and expanding northward as the streams flow in that part of the state. We also have them up on the Republican. So we had a good report from one of our department employees from Lovewell Reservoir. It's I don't know, maybe a year ago. But, you know, that's right north central Kansas, north and a little bit west of Salina. And one report, not a confirmation, but a report that always stands out to me is I got a phone call from a guy and he didn't get a picture, so I wasn't able to verify it or anything. But he was in St. Francis, and the Republican River runs through there. And there are otters on the Republican in Kansas and Nebraska. So when people say how far west can they go, well, they may be clear on the western edge, but generally they run out where the water runs out. And so I like to think their possible range is wherever we have beavers. You know, that might be a good way to describe them. If you have enough permanent water to support beavers, you probably have enough permanent water to support otters, or at least nearly as much. And so
interesting.
Certainly basically the eastern half of the state is a possible range. And then anything west of there, the water can be pretty sporadic at times.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if they got onto the big reservoirs and that they were permanently around them some. Mm-hmm. But as far as being up and down the streams, it's probably less predictable.
So like Wakanda Lake out there, Glen Elder, Kerwin, and the Solomon River coming into there. I grew up north of Hayes, up in Phillips County, and my dad lives on the Solomon River banks there. And that river, you might have a stretch of 3-4 years where there's enough water that you could catch some catfish, you know, that kind of thing. And there'd be beavers coming in and out of people's farm ponds out of that river. And then you might hit a 2 or 3 year stretch where it's pretty well dry and there's not much going on there except for, you know, watering cattle out of a low spot here and there.
Yeah, though during those high water years or times or the times when they could make their way out there, and then when the water receded, they would recede back to the big waters, you know. I mean, that's kind of how you expect them to operate. But so it's, you know, it's kind of undetermined what they might, how far out west they might get, but I don't see any reason why when the water's not high, they can't move on out farther west. They typically don't. I don't think that they, although they're capable of dispersing a long ways, they don't occur at real high densities usually. And so they don't expand their range real fast. Like I say, this is basically a 20-year phenomenon in Kansas. And so, you know, and they're still on the increase, like somewhat anecdotally, but also based on harvest reports, they're still increasing a lot here around Emporia and in this area. You know, we've got more of, you know, they're showing up unexpectedly. Beaver trappers are coming across them and stuff like that, where places that they have not come across them before. And so it's a nice surprise if you're a trapper. We also get, you know, I don't want to say it was controversial, because I think it was very defensible from a population perspective when we opened season, but it was there's enough negativity around otters that most people don't think about, that they were going to be killing some, whether by gun and state law that you can kill an animal for damage to your property in cases of stocked fish and stuff, or you can open season on them and give fur harvesters a chance to remove them as part of a legal harvest season, which is typically how we try to address damage issues. You know, if somebody's got deer damage, we do issue deer permits, but what we would rather is that hunters came in there and killed more deer during season, and you don't have to issue damage permits that way. And so the otter thing, it made sense to use the legal trapping season to try to curtail some of the problems that they get involved in. And like I said, stocked, they in big waters, they're typically not a problem. You're not going to notice having some otters in there, but in stocked ponds, people are feeding catfish, stuff like that. We've had them get into our hatcheries. You know, they can do some real damage.
That's interesting. That's good stuff. So Matt, I don't know if we even mentioned this to you before when we kind of sent you a brief outline about what we want to talk about, but we always do a lightning round of a few questions that are real easy, lighthearted questions, this or that, yes or no kind of thing. So I'm going to spring those on you if you're up for it.
Sure.
And then we'll want to be sure and have Brittany, I'm sure she's going to have some closing questions and thoughts too, but I'll jump in here to these lightning round questions. So I know you're a fur trapper, and I've been in the office before over the years. We've talked trapping and stuff and met a few different times at some events around Opie. And so anyway, a few of these questions kind of pertain to just my knowledge that I know that you're a fur trapper. So number one, would you prefer early or late season trapping, fur trapping? So I'm going to say before Christmas or after Christmas?
Oh, probably after, just because I'm also a deer hunter and do other things too. And so between various other commitments, a lot of my time comes available after Christmas.
Okay.
I do like, so that's my answer.
Okay. Question number two, back to trapping, fur trapping. Do you prefer trapping in the water or trapping dry land?
I suppose that's varied over the years. I've really gotten to enjoy beaver trapping lately with the waders on and out there in the water. And
man, that's a lot of work. Big, heavy
challenging
traps.
Yeah. Catching big animals.
Yeah.
I've had a really good time.
Okay.
The market's down, and so beaver cause a lot of damage, and so a lot of the trapping I do, or some of the trapping I do, is in response to people who know me and just call me and say, "Hey, I got a beaver cutting my trees down right here."
Yeah.
Or Bert. So people complain about beaver, and I can help them out by trapping them for them.
Yep. Okay. Yep. You said you're into some other things. So number three, you prefer to hunt upland or waterfowl?
Upland. I love pheasant and quail hunting. I wish it's the situation with the pheasants is rough right now. And I lived out in Lincoln and worked as a biologist technician, and then also been going out to Ellsworth County for 20 years running WEHA surveys out there, surveying hunters on our walk-in areas for opening day. And things are rough out there. We've lost a lot of habitat, and mm-hmm. we've lost a lot of our CRP, and the CRP that's left is in upland or in rangeland areas. And it's just rough. There's not a lot of places for them out there on the landscape right now. Plus coming off the drought that we had this year.
For sure. Okay. So you mentioned deer whitetail hunting, but we had our talk about trapping and the success in the otter establishment and growth in the state. So would you, pride's maybe not the right word, would you feel luckiest if you happened upon a big buck, is it buck otter, is that right? A male otter, a big male otter, or a large whitetail buck deer?
Oh, I don't know. That's a tough one. That's kind of a coin flip, I guess.
Okay. All right. Is it a buck otter? What do you call a male otter?
I always just call them a male otter. I don't know specifically. Yeah.
Okay.
Buck like otter sounds fun.
A murder of crows. I mean, everything's got its. Yeah. Okay.
I'll have to look that one up, I guess.
Okay. So do you look forward more towards fishing season or hunting season? Number five.
Oh, everything's got a season. I enjoy a lot of different things, including not all of it's harvest related, but probably hunting season. I've got my black lab dog and like I said, various other pursuits, but there's something to do all the time, you know.
Sure.
And if I'm not engaged in one of those activities, I'm usually preparing for it in one way or another.
So, mm-hmm. Understand. I think maybe you answered this in question three. I asked about the pursuit, whether it was upland or waterfowl. This one's more geared towards, you're going to invest some time, let's say a sunrise. So equal type morning, the perfect morning, either on the uplands. So not related to the harvest, not related to the, but just the investment of your time. You prefer the sunrise on the uplands or the sunrise at a marsh?
Got to go with the marsh on that one. There's nothing. I mean, it's not, sunrise is fine out on the deer hunting on the prairie or upland bird hunting, but being in the marsh at sunrise is, yeah, being at Cheyenne Bottoms as the sun comes up or something like that. There really is something magical about that.
Yep, for sure. Okay.
Muskrats swimming by and the birds, you know, the movement of birds and the non-game birds and stuff like that. It's just
priceless.
Really enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay. Final question, number seven. You mentioned a black lab, and I'm a Labrador man. I've got a yellow lab. I don't know if you know the Department of Wildlife and Parks magazine. The last issue, there was a yellow lab with some prairie chickens. That's actually my dog. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Meg, that's, is famous.
Yeah. Meg, the warrior princess. So, but anyway, bird dog or coon hound?
Oh, that's a tough one. My brother's got coon hounds now, and I used to have coon hounds. So I'm fond of coon hounds, but I guess I'm a black lab guy now. So, and have been for a long time. So I guess I got to go with my black lab Moby.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, that didn't sting too bad.
No.
Not bad at all. You did pretty good. Usually we have people really fretting about defending their answers. You kept your cool.
Oh, yeah.
10 out of 10 for sure.
All right.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. It was kind of fun to talk to you about these different topics that I think all of us see in the news at time to time, and talk about it at different coffee shops, as Rob says. So it's fun to get some scientific input from somebody who knows a lot about what they're doing. So thank you for sharing that wisdom with us.
All right. Well, thank you, Brittany and Rob. I appreciate you having me, and it was fun.
Yeah, it was. How can folks connect with you if they have any questions about, you know, what they might be seeing on trail cameras, or if they do happen to catch something very interesting on camera at some point? How can they find you?
I work out of the Emporia Research and Survey office. And so just contact the office. And of course, the number to that is in, you know, all the various places that publicize department locations, including our website.
Yep. That's a quick Google search away. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Matt, thank you so, so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you both again. I appreciate it as well.
All right. See you guys.
Yep.
We'll see ya.